Thank you, Andy. Thank you all for being here. It's exciting to see interest in the park and recreation field here. Like Andy said, I'm Zernaz Bashir. I'm with the National Recreation and Park Association. I have no relationships to disclose. A little bit of background on our organization. We were developed back in 1965, and we represent all of the local park and rec agencies across the country. So that's about 12,000 local park and rec agencies. We have about 47,000 members, and those agencies represent over 100,000 local parks across the country. And so we like to say we touch the lives of all Americans across the country. And so, you know, what's the big deal about Parks and Rec? Well, we are in a state of transition, I would say, especially among the Park and Rec community, where we now have a seat at the public health table. Very important, Park and Rec agencies have been, when they think about health and wellness, we think about sports and fitness and playgrounds and programming and things like that. But there's been a transition into creating healthier environments, Parks and Rec being part of the built environment, helping create healthier choices in neighborhoods. And so there's that saying that we've engineered physical activity out of our lives. A priority at NRPA is to bring that back in and really help Park and Rec agencies offer not just physical activity opportunities to residents, but also opportunity for access to nutritious foods. And so we think about smart growth as an example. And for those of you who don't know what smart growth is, it's building urban, suburban, and rural communities in a way that it really connects the community's housing and transportation choices near jobs, grocery stores, schools, where people live, work, and play. And so when people are planning their communities, Parks and Rec is often an afterthought. And so we need to start bringing that into the very beginning of the conversation. And so I'm not going to go through all of the evidence. I think there's quite a decent amount. I think we could do some more, and we'll be hearing about some great research that links park and rec agencies to increased levels of physical activity. There's also a decent amount of evidence out there about being outdoors and the value that it brings, not just to physical health, but mental health. There was this great study in Georgia among 3,000 youth which showed that youth that live close to a park were 2 to 3 times more likely to walk within a 2-day period than those that did not live within a half a mile of a park. So the benefits of parks is vast. It's beyond just health. There's economic benefits, environmental benefits, and social benefits. It really brings a sense of community among residents. So the problem here that we were trying to address is around childhood obesity. We focus on children when talking about play deserts just because that's kind of the first step. We didn't want to, you know, broaden this out just yet, although that would be a next step to this research that we did. But back in 2012, we were talking with the CDC and kind of following the footsteps of food deserts, thought about how access to parks is essential in communities and how can we really improve that. There's a lot of research out there that shows that certain racial and ethnic groups, there's certain disadvantaged groups that lack access to a park. So how can we help address that and resolve that? And so that began our work on play deserts. And what we did back in 2012 is we held 2 focus group discussions with key leaders across the country, one of whom is sitting in this room, Deb Cohen is here. So glad you're here, Deb. And so Trust for Public Land, RAND, the National Park Service, and a variety of researchers gathered on the phone, and we wanted to create a definition of a play desert, a standard definition that's measurable, feasible, and actionable. And so a lot of people talk about, and we had some great conversations about this, but you know, I live with a cul-de-sac in my neighborhood. That's a place for play. Yes, it is, but we see that more as a temporary solution, or, you know, somebody talked about a treehouse in their backyard. We were looking for public parks, recreation, and open space as a sustainable area in which youth can be active and play. And so we created our definition, and I actually meant to put this up on my slide, but The definition was a geographical area that does not have a play space, such as a public park, rec center, or green space, present and accessible for use by youth for active play. And so the way we did this is on our focus group calls, we asked a few questions. One was to identify and prioritize the key constructs that should be considered in developing a definition for play deserts, identify the available resources and gaps in resources needed to measure and map play deserts, and identify the key elements to be included in a play desert definition research agenda. And so we held these calls and we asked questions like, what is the public health impact of a play desert? What's the appropriate methodology for mapping and measuring play deserts? And what we found is there's not a lot of resources out there to measure and map play deserts. But we certainly could come up with some criteria and a definition for that. We also gained buy-in from various stakeholders like the National Recreation Park Association Conference, which brings together local park professionals from across the country. We held focus groups with them. We also were at Active Living Research and the Partnership for Health America, Healthier America Conference to gain buy-in from various audiences before we finalized our definition. And so from these conversations, we identified four key constructs to a play desert. So the first one at top there is presence. Is there a presence of a park? That's pretty simple. Is there a park there or not? If there's not a park there, obviously you have a play desert situation. Where things get sticky is when you move to the next one, which is access to a park. So you can have a park in your neighborhood, but if you can't access it, what's the point? And so when we talk about access, we're talking about that ability to walk to the space and to be able to participate in opportunities provided by that space. And so there are various factors that go into that: proximity, safety, and the actual walking infrastructure. And then we move into quality of the space. So you can have the park there and you can access it, but when you get there, it's pretty lame. So we're talking about, you know, the characteristics and the conditions of the space, which could include the programs offered, the facilities and amenities available, the staff and the maintenance, and their funding resources. And then finally, use. So you have the park, you can access it, it's of great quality, but nobody knows about it. So that's actually considered a play desert as well. And so programming and supervision of programming is really important there. There have been studies that have shown that there's increased park visitation and usage when programs that are supervised are being offered at a park and rec agency. And so that's a little, also shared use agreements are really important here as a way to kind of reduce duplication of efforts and maximize resources that are available by different entities. So given that background on the four constructs, I just wanted to go over how the constructs can be put into action. And we have some great examples. For example, the city of LA, which actually mapped life expectancy, prevalence of childhood obesity, and park access to improve access in their communities. And so what you see here are some of their maps. The first map looks at life expectancy, and then the second one is childhood obesity rates, and the third is overall park access. And from there, they developed this map in which to focus areas on in developing parks or creating park revitalization programs. And so to date, so this was the 50 Parks Initiative, and they wanted communities to be within a half mile of those sites. And so to date, they have 21 parks completed, 6 in construction, and 23 in design. As you can see up there, approximately 670,000 people now live within a half mile of these sites. That is 170,000 more than before this program started. So they were able to improve access for 170,000 more people. In Miami-Dade, they did the same thing. They wanted to actually make sure that there was access to a park within a quarter to a half mile. That number often changes within communities. Some people say half a mile, some people say a quarter. you know, we don't have any preference, but we do say half mile just because we want people to walk to the park and get some exercise while they're getting there. And so they did a mapping exercise where they looked at cardiovascular mortality, bike and pedestrian accidents, and overlaid this data over people who had a quarter to a half mile walkable access to a park. And then from there, they were able to select focus areas for park improvements. And this is really helpful, especially when talking about health disparities and wanting to make sure that everyone has access to a park. Miami's actually going to be talking tomorrow morning at a session at 8:30. This is part of their presentation. And so a little bit of an example of park use and quality. This is a small town in Hernando, Mississippi. In 2004, there was no parks department at all in Hernando, Mississippi. And in 2006, so they got this amazing mayor who's a big physical activity advocate and wanted to build a parks department. So in 2 years, in 2006, they achieved getting 25 and a half acres of parkland. And then today, they have 130 and a half acres of parkland. And so from that, they haven't done any rigorous evaluation. They are a small city, and it takes baby steps. But they do see more use and more people and improved health in their community. Another example is a project that we work on at NRPA called Parksville Community. And the pictures, the two pictures on the left there are the before pictures. And this is a park in Houston, a very underserved community, low-income community. And on the right, you see the rendition of, you know, what this park could look like if we build in some walking paths, make it prettier with some trees, build in some equipment. And then what you see here is what it looks like today. So, and you can even see that there is more, a lot more people accessing that park. And so we are currently engaged in some evaluation activities on the health impact of that. Just a quick example also about quality and use. I mentioned safety earlier. So Chicago Park District is does an amazing job at safe park zones where they are reducing speeds around the park so that it's safer for people to access the park. And so they've seen some drastic changes in the number of park visitations, and they really enforce their safe park zone laws. I think in some cases, if people pass the speed limit, there's something like $500 charges to that. So it's pretty enforced. And this is throughout Illinois, actually. And then finally, safety and crime. When I talk about programming as increasing park use, this is a great example, actually, in L.A., summer nightlights, where they keep the parks open at night during the summer hours, and they've done some pretty intense evaluation of this program, and it's actually gone pretty national. But as you can see there from the data, you know, the crime rates have reduced, and they're keeping more kids who are more prone to be out in gang-related activity. The number of gang-related homicides had reduced as well. And so as a next step for our research, so we have a report that we put together, and I'm happy to share with anyone, but including the definition and the four constructs, we did develop some resources, a framework that people can use if they want to define and identify play deserts in their communities, also outlining some of the resources that are currently available. And so what's listed here are some of the beginnings of a national repository of local parks, but we really need to do a better job on that. As I mentioned, we have over 100,000 local parks across the country, so it's a very overwhelming task to have to map these. But I think a lot of that is being done at the local level. So we've been talking with the CDC and the National Park Service about engaging in an effort around that. And so finally, just in terms of making an impact, with our play desert definition, we do want people to know that it's not a one-size-fits-all. There are many considerations that go into defining whether you live in a play desert or have a play desert in your community. For First of all, play deserts affect multiple geographic levels. There could be a play desert at the local level, state level, national parks as well. And so the data that might be available for those geographic levels may vary. So that's one consideration. Also, temporary solutions. So I talked about cul-de-sacs and tree houses, vacant lots. You might have heard about a program called Play Streets, which I believe began in Philadelphia, where they actually cut off streets and throw out lots of equipment and fun activities for kids because they're lacking that kind of park and public recreation type of facility for the kids to play. So it's a great temporary solution for that. But again, we're looking for solutions that are permanent and more sustainable in communities when we talk about play deserts. Rural communities have fewer parks, but they definitely have a lot of green space. So if a rural community is talking about play deserts, they should consider within their definition how they can utilize the green space for getting youth active. And then one issue that came up a lot is climate. So you might live in a state that's very, very cold and people don't want to go outside, or you live in a very sunny area and people don't want to be out in the sun. So you have, you know, a lot of issues to consider when you're talking about play deserts. And then finally, inequities. Of course, based on, you know, age, race, ethnicity, park access, there's all sorts of variables that need to be considered when talking about play deserts and making sure everyone has access to those opportunities. And so with that, I'm happy to share the report with anyone. If you want to give me your email, I can send that to you. We are looking to publish these results with the CDC, and so that should be coming out in the next few months as well. Thank you.